take a girl and a guy, and they fall madly in love and form a family. Sprinkle in some counseling degrees and a doctorate, a dream of transforming relationships as we know it. And 20 years later, we give you power couple Dr. Ray and Jean Kedkodian. And this is their podcast, Couples Synergy.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Couple Synergy with Dr. Ray and Jean. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray.
And I'm Jean. And this is our podcast about love, marriage, and relationships.
Please check us out online at couplesynergy.com or on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Couple Synergy. And please subscribe to our podcast, leave us a review, or send us any suggestions on topics you'd like to hear more about. And now on to Couple Synergy, an in-depth look at love, marriage, and relationships, where we bring you our experience helping thousands of couples transform their relationships for over 25 years.
You know, everyone says you should work on your relationship, but nobody teaches us how. So we've created this podcast to teach people what they can do to create the relationship they've always dreamed of.
With the partner they fell in love with. On today's episode, we welcome Esther Siegel and Spencer Brewer. They've been a couple for nearly 5 decades, and they are co-authors of Lost and Found, Assemblage Artists of Northern California. Thank you so much, Esther and Spencer, for being on our podcast today.
We're looking forward to it.
Thanks for having us.
We've enjoyed watching your previous ones.
Great. Thanks. That's awesome to hear. Well, you know, before we get into what you guys do, why don't you guys tell us a little bit about yourselves? You know, how old are you and how long have you been together? Obviously 5 decades, right? And then what do you do for a living?
Well,
go for it.
I'm almost 73 next week. And I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. I also teach horseback riding, and I've been doing both of those for 35 plus years. I also use horses in therapy, doing equine assisted psychotherapy. It's a ground activity, it's not a riding activity. And I got into art, never was an artist, never identified as an artist, never took any classes, started out doing scrapbooking with my family photos and moved into greeting cards, making unique greeting cards, pop-up cards, exploding box cards.
And you taught classes on it too.
Yeah, I love three-dimensional stuff. So I had a lot of three-dimensional cards. And then I moved into book art, which is taking a book and folding it in particular ways that you have a teapot or you have an animal and I started putting three-dimensional objects on that. And that's how I kind of moved into this assemblage art, by using three-dimensional objects. And basically assemblage art is where you paint or you do a sculpture with objects instead of having the artistic talent of making a using paint or pencils or something and making it look perfect like something else. You take objects and you make new things out of it, new shapes. So that's a little bit about me and where I'm at right now.
I've been in the music business most of my entire life. I am a composer. I've got 15 albums out. And then I was a record producer and a concert promoter for many years. Made a lot of records with a lot of people. And I've been a piano technician. I'm a master piano technician, been doing that for 45 years. And through all this, I've been in various mediums of art throughout my life. Obviously, music. And in the physical realm, I used to do art when I was much younger, drawing pointillism. Then I got into making weird sculptures out of things you find in a salvage yard to make musical instruments, and did that with modern dance companies and created stuff in the background with that. And then we had a music store, rebuilding pianos, selling all kinds of instruments, repairing instruments. And when we finally closed the store down, we moved the shop here to the property. And through a series of events, I got out of the music business. And my focus was, now we had this barn filled with tools, filled with old music parts. So I started making assemblage art out of instruments and other things that we had collected. little did either one of us know that's what we were doing when we started it. It was very organic. It was natural for me to get into it from this angle. And it just kept expanding and expanding to where we were doing galleries and museums and showings and things of this nature. Then we created the book, as Esther was talking about, and then what you all are referencing, which brought us into this whole paradigm of what else can this do, this book and this concept and this medium. That's the short version.
Cool. Can you tell us a story where you met?
Well,
okay. I was a single parent of a 3-year-old at the time, and I was called in to work at a place that I had stopped working at because somebody was going on vacation, and it was a pharmacy that sold herbs, and this was in the early 70s. And so I just filled in for Tom for about 4 or 5 days. And Spencer was on the road as a traveling herb salesman.
Herb, ginseng, and naturopathic care product stuff out of Austin, Texas, when I wasn't living as a musician down there. Go ahead.
So he was traveling 4 states and making a circle, Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma.
Picture a hippie van with all the hippie curtains, and it smelled heavenly because it had all this incense and all these smell good things you would sell to health food stores and co-ops.
So he was en route, but he wasn't supposed to stop at our store because we were just too little, this tiny little town in Arkansas called Eureka Springs. So
I walk in. I wasn't supposed to be there. She said, I stayed at a friend's house. She said, oh, you got to go see this little apothecary shop in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. It wasn't on my list. And it was in the beautiful Ozarks, driving from Tulsa into the Ozarks. And so I said, I'm not going there. He said, you really got to go. There's an herb lady. She does herb walks. I mean, it's just a great little store. So I walk into this store, and she's standing behind the counter with her mountain dress and hippie boots on. And she gives me this huge grin. And I tell him the name of the company was Sweetheart Herbs. And so I tell him, Sweetheart Herbs, we were the big herb company at that point, alternative herb company. And she and Jerry, the pharmacist, who is also, he owned the place, they go, oh my God, Sweetheart's here. So I turn around to go get my stuff in the van, you know, show and tell. I'm there to sell stuff. And I turn around at the door and look at her, and she's standing behind the counter with that grin. And I said to her 5 minutes later, you know, I could easily fall in love with you. And she looks at me and goes, I was thinking just the same thing. And so I walk out. She turns to Jerry and says,
Jerry, haven't we met this guy before? He's so familiar. I mean, I said, Jerry, come on. I know we've met this guy. There's just something about him that's so familiar. And he goes, no, I don't think so.
But if you don't take him home tonight, I will.
Because Jerry was gay. And so that was going to work with him.
That's how we met.
So he was there for about a couple hours giving us free samples and taking an order, a big herb order for our little store. And he asked me to leave with him right from the work and go to New Orleans because he was on his way to New Orleans.
Why not?
And I said, I can't, I'm working. And he, I guess he called the pharmacist because he ended up sending me roses that next day. And no one had ever sent me roses, and called me, and we started talking, and he sent me a bus ticket to go to Texas where he lived with my son. And it was an up and down ride the last 48 years. Something like that.
49 years this year.
And a lot of therapy. And he ended up adopting my son, and who's now 51, hard to believe. So that's the very beginning story. Yeah.
That's the Cliff Notes version.
And what was it about each other that you fell in love with?
Well, I love her smile. I mean, I just can't get over her smile, you know, and I thought she was cute, and she hates that word. She hates being cute. So I was very attracted to her, and we both kind of recognized each other the minute we saw each other. I mean, almost instantly. I never had that feeling before.
Yeah. And I had been picking relationships and men that really didn't have much of a life. And I kind of provided a lot of energy to the relationship and introduced them to stuff. And here's this guy that walks in the store and he's totally into what I'm into, which is herbs. And he's got tons of energy and he's managing his life in a cool way. He's traveling, living in a van. And he just seemed very different than anybody I had met. And so, you know,
musician too, that throw that in there.
The eyes, definitely the eyes, I got hooked, and the smile. And, you know, there's a lot of visual things that happen, that when you first meet somebody or what attracts you. And, you know, usually you don't talk about that all that much, but there were definitely some visuals from both of us that mm-hmm. clicked, and we initially, traveled together. And we found that we didn't actually really know each other. So we kind of took a little break and then we missed each other. And that was the kind of, and we never separated since. But at the very beginning, it was, you know, there's a lot more to a person than just their looks and their energy. Like, what are their values, and how do they interact with others in the world? And we both had a little conflict and had to learn how to accept each other.
There's no power struggle with us. We're both firstborns. No power struggle there whatsoever.
Yeah, so we had some of that too.
So is that the up and down ride that yes. you were referring to?
Well, there's many aspects yes. to that up and down ride, not just power struggles that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, there was some, you know,
there was some infidelity along the way on my part. There was, you know, I'm an extrovert, front of house. She's an introvert. And, you know, there was not much humor and joking in her house. Our house is all about the level of sarcasm shows the level of love you have. She couldn't even spell the word, you know.
So we had to figure out, you know,
so many aspects.
I had to live with his sense of humor, and we actually figured out a little signal. It's like this, taking your two little fingers. Because I would get so offended by what he would say, and he was being sarcastic.
Or funny.
Or funny, and I didn't get it. And so when we figured this out, when he gave me this little signal, I just relaxed. Oh, it's just
he gave
her
the cue, I'm joking.
I didn't have to get all ramped up about, like, that's not nice.
Now, it doesn't mean I remember it often, but that does help when I do remember.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we did a lot of counseling over the years, lots and lots of workshops.
Our most meaningful counseling was, we were in a psychodrama group that met once a month for a weekend. And we were the only couple. The rest were individuals.
There were nine of us, and we did this for 4 straight years.
And it was more...
it was intense.
Experiential. And we were able to really get to know ourselves in a different way than just kind of traditional psychotherapy.
And a lot of extra tools because of, you know, we're witnessing and participating in everybody else's psychodrama. So that really helps a great deal. And then the thing that was the most powerful for me along our trek was doing Reikian therapy, really intensive Reikian therapy, so I could I could help lose the anger of growing up in my father's house. So that was really healing for me at the time.
So what I think that's one of the things that actually probably helped us deal with the things that bothered each other, which was that we have the same values about mm-hmm. personal growth.
Yeah.
And it kind of superseded some of the other problems that you have when you live with someone, you're married with them, that there was always this willingness to address the issues in whatever way we could.
It kind of held you guys together.
It helped held us together. And I also, in listening to your first podcast where you're talking about, we argue and it's really good, and part of the thing of what you do after you argue, the thing that we, as much as, you know, we want to just sometimes just really, just, you know, get really angry with each other, we never hit below the belt, not once. We did not call names once. Now, it didn't mean that we didn't think it, we didn't want to, but it was like an unwritten rule for us that we're just not going to go there. And I really think that that helps not chip away at the core of why you're together and what you're meant to each other.
I remember early on in the relationship, he told me, I never want to be slapped in my face. And I never even thought that I'd ever slap anybody anyway. And so I said, okay, I don't want you to call me the B word. I never want to hear that. And, you know, we've stuck to that. But it was interesting. I don't know if couples do that very often. It's like, what's their bottom line, you know?
And stick to it.
And stick to it.
In the heat of the moment, which we all know that they can come up.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of couples don't know what their bottom line is.
It's true. Yeah. That's true. I mean, I hadn't thought of it until he actually told me his.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
How did you guys recover from the period of infidelity?
Long and arduous.
So there are a couple things that we did specifically is that we got the book or the audio tape. It's called After the Affair. And there's one for the betrayer and the one for the betrayed. And we both listened to each our own, but also the other. Spencer got, he recognized that he might have like a love addiction. And he got involved. This was a big turning point for me. He got involved with the 12-step program for a while.
I never know there's a Romantics Anonymous. That was a new one for
and
me.
And so that was, to me, it was like, okay, there's going below the surface of just apologizing and saying, I'm not going to do it again.
And then we did, we were with, there was, we needed to find, since she's a therapist around here, we couldn't use anybody locally. So we tried to find somebody out of the area, and we found this guy that other therapists, friends of ours, said, all right, he's the therapist. And so we went and saw him for years. We'd show up sometimes, and we're in a great mood, but we just still were committed to going. And as much as there's always perceived when there is infidelity, there's the perception of there's a perpetrator and the one who got betrayed. Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a combination of what set this up? How did this get here? Where was the disconnect? And it came through, we had to go through a lot of digging to where I was not the bad guy all the time, to where finally he says, oh, well, the paradigm was here for this to happen because this need wasn't being met. This was not being addressed. There was very little affection coming from her at the time. And I just needed to seek it out somewhere else. And there's a bunch of other reasons on top of that. But it over time, she said at one time, I'll never be able to trust you 100% again. And I took that to heart. I took it to heart. And it's true. In saying that, when she feels insecure about something, or who's that on the phone, or where are you going tonight, or a bunch of different things, I realize she's coming from a place of she really just needs to feel safe and know. And so I really don't get upset. I said, well, I'm going to go do this and here, check this out. And I'm very open with that.
Yeah, that was really helpful that he would share if he was like attracted to someone. I had a riding instructor that came out and gave me a lesson. And after he left, he said, she's pretty attractive. I said, really? I mean, you were thinking that about her? I mean, so I have learned a little bit more about the male mind.
Then at this time, I was helping with a stage production. We were calling it the Manologues. Because the female monologues are going around the country.
Vagina monologues.
So we did this whole workshop, the monologues, men's cocktails. And what ended up occurring out of this thing was that I did this whole psychodrama with all these different people on stage about what men think. And we can't control it. We control it, but we can't stop the thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I put it out to the community for multiple performances. And I had all these men and women coming up to me afterwards, especially men. How dare you say that? I didn't want anybody to know that's what I think. How could you do this? And the women were coming up and says, is that what all men really think? Is that what they really, is that
about,
what's going through their heads
other women,
about other women? Mm-hmm. They may never say it or act on it, but is that really always going on back there? And with that, Esther at the stalls one day, she goes, okay, I really want to know, what is it that's going through your head right now? Because I think that writing instructor was here that day. And I said, now you really want to know exactly what I just thought. She goes, yeah, no, you're not going to be upset because I can't control it. It's just going through. Yeah. So I told her and she goes, thank you very much. I'm shocked. And you can't stop that. I said, I can't stop it. I can control it, but I can't stop it. And that was also a turning point.
Yeah, there's something about, I mean, I think we took it to another level that most people never would, which is putting it out publicly. And there were other men in that performance that put out other secrets that they had and other issues they had. So it was a multi-dimensional show. But there was something about his willingness to just go 100 all the way that helped me feel, you know, the strength of our commitment in the relationship and his commitment to his own personal growth.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it sounds like by you telling her what you're thinking, it provides more certainty for you, right? You know, now you don't have to wonder.
Right. Right.
Right. That he's going to let you know.
Right.
And it probably also diffuses whatever you're feeling.
Yeah. Well, in terms of, are you talking to me?
Spencer.
Oh, Spencer.
Oh, it diffuses what I'm feeling. Yeah. It's, I would think so. It does for me to say it when
out loud,
you know, I really do wish that growing up in the 50s and 60s, you know, all the ads and the sexualization and all this stuff was just not crammed. I mean, it's not just that period of time. It's just when I grew up, just crammed down our throat to where if I never saw another female again, the images will never stop. The desires will never stop. The running yammy yammies are never going to quit.
It's 10 times worse today.
It's hardwired.
It's way worse. Kids are getting exposed to porn in elementary school.
It's way worse
today. Scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and I think it hijacks you.
Yeah, exactly. It hijacks me. And I'm really telling the truth here. I'm really glad I've dropped testosterone levels a lot. I think it is so wonderful as you age that, you know, you're just not this walking cauldron of testosterone. It's great that happens over time.
So, you know, tell us about what prompted you to become a therapist then.
Okay. So I was on track at college. I dropped out of college after a year and a half in the late 60s and decided to go back to school after I met Spencer to go into a college for horses. I wanted to pursue horses, my love.
Equestrian science.
And so I went to an all-girls school to get an equestrian science degree. And an incident happened where my sister came to visit and we lived across from the state mental hospital in Fulton, Missouri. And because my sister was there, I got the guts to say, let's go over and visit the hospital. I was just curious what the hospital looked like.
How many people want a tour of a, you know, mental institution? But they did.
So we went in and I said, hi, can we look around? And she goes, no, but you could volunteer. I said, interesting. So I ended up volunteering and I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I brought art materials up to the top floor of the chronic schizophrenia long-term males. And it was just like in the movies with the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, lots of locks and stairways and cages to get through. And I didn't know what I was doing, but I just sat down and, you know, started talking to people and having them draw. And I'd come home and my mind was just racing with questions about mental illness and what was the difference between them and me and what made mental illness. And the long and short of it is I started doing a lot of volunteering there and I started taking psychology classes and I switched my degree to psychology. And all the volunteering work I did, I was able to put into a classes of independent study. Ended up getting psychology student of the year and switched my degree and knew I wanted to be a psychotherapist. And the only, in the 80s, early 80s, the only more progressive schools in the States were on the West Coast. Most of the psychology programs were around research. So we moved to the West Coast and went to school at John F. Kennedy in Northern California. And when we graduated, we were tired of renting, so we wanted to buy some land, but we couldn't afford anything in the Bay Area, and I wanted something with where I could have a horse. So we moved 2.5 hours north to where the vineyards are just ending and the redwoods are just starting. We're about an hour and 10 minutes from Pacific Ocean, Mendocino, and Fort Bragg. So it's a really nice place to live, and it's more a little more progressive area politically and everything, open to arts of all kinds. So we've been here 40 some
we've been
years?
Here 39 years 39 this year.
39 years, yeah. Wow. So that's how I got into psychotherapy.
Okay.
and she's also been a clinical supervisor for other therapists.
Yeah. Done a lot of things in the psychotherapy world. Substance abuse, a lot of substance abuse work. And
okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the artwork and kind of how did this start, and what prompted the book, and what's upcoming for you
okay.
guys?
Well, we were doing the art together. I was doing it on my own, and she started doing it, and we were supporting each other in the barn. We have a pretty large barn filled with thousands of objects.
So let me say something here. The cool thing about assemblage art is that you get to collect things, and you collect interesting, cool
Very
things,
interesting stuff.
Shapes, old things, glittery things, things that that you like. And so once you start collecting things, you have to start categorizing them and organizing them. And so we started doing that, as you could imagine, thrift shops and flea markets and estate sales and, just going through this, our stuff that we were going to throw away, like bottle caps, now become an object. So I just wanted to intervene that.
That's part. Fine. So we started doing it, and she started doing it in the barn as well, doing her own. And we found that we were supporting each other of, well, have you tried this? We'd walk up. Have you tried it? We'd look at the other's art and put something on it. And says, no, I don't like that or I like that. And the key here was not being attached to them liking what we're suggesting. Very, very important. It's just an artistic suggestion. And then we've done a few together. And through all this, Esther wanted to find more periodicals, books, or magazines that had to do with this particular art form. So she was going online and buying whatever was out there. And there was maybe a half a dozen that were dedicated to just the art itself, not the making of it, the crafting way of doing it, but just as a catalog, so to speak. And most of those books were the artist had one page and then one page of their art. That's it. Now remember, there's only a half a dozen in the country that we could find. So she said, couldn't find any more. There are no magazines. There were no periodicals. And she says, well, why don't we make our own book? And I've been a producer of records for years and years and years, and wine labels. So I said, well, yeah, I just kicked in because my producer.
At first you said, you were a little reluctant.
Probably.
And he was a little reluctant because I think he was a little overwhelmed with the idea of making a book.
Because I know what it means to make something and that we've never been in the publishing world. And you're still producing something. There's still the ways to do it. It's a new language. It's just a whole new paradigm.
So this book is the first time we've actually done a project together. Spencer has done lots of concerts and
we'll show this.
Oh, here's the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
There we go.
So this is the first time we've done a project together where I'm not in the background, and he's the front man, and everybody's talking about how wonderful he is. So this was a whole new gig for us, and it's really taken our relationship to another level.
So the thing that we've really gotten close about is this book, making the book together and then going through the process has brought our relationship from a me to a we. And it's really simple when we say it that way, is that I would come up with projects or productions or things of this nature, financial, whatever it is around the property. And, you know, I would charge forward. Here we go. I'm going to go do this. And she would support me. She's going to do one horses or do something with the out here. I would support her in that. But it was her doing her thing and me doing my thing. That's a me thing. We didn't sign our emails. We didn't do any of this. And all of a sudden, this book took on a we scenario to where there's thousands and thousands of decisions. I mean, there's 330 photographs alone. And so with that, the paradigm, and we battled over this one sometimes just because she said, why wasn't I on that email or that decision? Or why didn't you include me in this? And she was right. She was totally right. I'm just used to, I know what it needs to get done. Let's just go do it and move on to the next thing because there's a long pile behind that. So it shifted our relationship from a me to a we, and now it's gone deeper, way outside the book and the art form, to where I am literally signing my emails, Spencer and Esther, our correspondence that way, coming to her with decisions I would normally never include her in just because I didn't think it mattered. What else could you say about that?
What did I miss? That I had something to say.
I was going to say, do you know what we call that?
What's that?
We call it synergy.
I was just thinking
there you go.
You said that.
Of course, there
and
you
I
go.
I was thinking of that. Right. I know what I was going to say. I know that we could not have done this earlier in our relationship.
No, this would have never happened.
His ego was way much bigger and he needed the accolades all often, but the personal work and the, you know, like the beach, you know, the infidelity, all that stuff kind of changes a person. And he was open to me being that really equal partner.
I still have to struggle in this. Because I come from a marketing background. I come from a production background. So she's very willing to go along and she wants to learn. And I've tried a lot of times it's patience going, I'm computer savvy and she's not as much. So it's me practicing. She's a great teacher for me to practice patience. And that's what
I don't think that union is really possible until you have a lot of years under your belt. As a couple, yeah. Right? We talk about it being a forging. There's a forging stage.
Oh, there you go.
And I think also post-menopause and menopause.
And chip in.
Because your brain shifts.
Yeah.
You know, in puberty, your brain, the female brain rewires to be pleasing to others.
Mm.
And it reverses to be more pleasing to yourself during menopause. And then you stop making all those allowances for people who are treating you in a way that you really don't like. And then I think that expectation on the female end also shows up in the relationship where it's like, you know, this is going to shift or this isn't going to mm-hmm. happen.
Yeah. You know, Carl Jung talks about the mm-hmm. shift from morning of life to the afternoon of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for men, it's the same thing where in the morning of life, there's this focus of success and, you know, the accolades and climbing the ladder and that yep. sort of thing. But then the shift into the afternoon of life where now it's like, what's truly important, right? Is the relationships that we have with people and our connection to spirituality and something greater than ourselves. And so, you know, that's kind of what I'm hearing. And, you know, we go through that. We still go through that. I mean, we've been together now we're going to be together 27 years, mm-hmm. celebrate 26 years. But we've had to kind of go through that push, pull, tug of war kind of thing to find that unity, right? That synergy of creating something that is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that has been become obvious to me is that I have good ideas that I do, you know, that Spencer, you know, says, he'll turn to me and say, that's a great idea. I mean, and you know, it's kind of continuing to build my self-esteem and that, you know, I have worth and
the
it's
art,
very affirming.
The art you've been producing is also a manifestation of that. Because in the very beginning, you're super insecure with it and you've been getting a lot of accolades for the stuff you're making.
Yeah, calling a person yourself an artist is
still hard for
it's not easy.
It's not hard.
People do call me an artist and We just, for the first time, were asked to be jurors for an art show together. And wow, that's like another level that I never thought I'd ever be at. And so it's cool. It's like...
Now, there's some book fairs that are coming up, and our agent is putting us up to possibly be
a panelist
or a keynote speaker about some of this.
Keynote, well, but a
panelist. I hope not. A panelist, that'd be better.
And so we're kind of in, you know, the later part of our life. You know, we have friends who are losing
their partners,
or they're having illness, and
a lot of illness.
People are talking about dying more and this and that. And we're on this whole upswing of creativity and a project together for the first time.
So our agent tells us this morning, we just got an order from India for a whole bunch of books. And so they just came back, the marketing team, and they're ecstatic for us to go do a book tour in India.
And we're looking
forward
to it.
Yes, we'll go do that. Yeah, please, when, what date? So who knows for this thing? It led us to you guys. Here we are. And that's
awesome. It's
opening a lot of doors.
It's opening doors we didn't know were here.
In terms of people our age, it's not, we don't have a lot of peers that are embarking on new adventures. So,
yeah, that'd be so
in some ways it's maybe a little lonely. You know, but it is what it is. We're excited about it, and it is bringing us closer together, and we enjoy each other's art, and we find objects for each other. And Spencer loves taking things apart. So he'll find some old electronics, and I'm looking at this box. It's like nothing. It's like, what are you going to do with that? And he goes, it's the insides. I want the insides. And he'll spend hours taking it apart. And like,
and we have
kid.
Some cool parts there.
He's like a little
And you
kid.
Know what? I pull this part out. She walks back. Oh, that's mine. And she takes it and walks away with it. So, you know, don't get on my case about what I'm bringing
in.
I know. She loves that. So what we've taken now is that it's a new level with this is now we're doing assemblage camps. And so keep people sign up. We maximum is 8, and they come to the barn. There's a theme around a box. We've had it recently,
a case.
And we have 7 or 8 different stations around the inside of the barn, and they have access to 95% what's in there. And it's massive how much stuff is in there, or they'll bring some of their own. And they're there for 8 hours. We bring them lunch, and she and I we cannot stop. There's so much energy in the room. How do I do this? How do I do all that? What do you think about this? And so at the end of the day, even though we're exhausted, we look at each other across the room doing this and grin at each other. Yes. Can you believe what we're doing? We're in a room of people that have never held a screwdriver or walked in here that I have no skill, no creativity, and they're in bliss. They're bringing home something they made with their own hands today. That's pretty special. That's pretty magical for us.
That is. And now you guys put this whole thing together, coming together, and this project is something that couples can do together as well, right?
Yeah. In fact, we've come up with these small little boxes. They're these wooden cigar boxes called Out of the Box. And we have the starter kit, Out of the Box starter kits. And it's not like we're selling these things. We've been sending them to various people that our agent and our PR people want us to send to. But anybody can do this. You go around your house. We have a video on our website that's all about doing this. It shows us opening a box and then doing it together. It's all in fast motion. But let's say you're taking the stuff out of grandma's drawer, the appliance that's broken, the junk in the back in the garage you don't know what to do with. And I call it window shoppings. So you both go window shopping.
Around your house.
Around your house.
Could.
Just whatever appeals to you, whatever you like.
Know, photos, broken jewelry.
Whatever it is.
An odd spoon that you're keeping around because it's got a cool design on it.
And I can't let go of that. That was my great-grandmother's, you know. And so you bring this and you pile it all on the table in front of you. And you decide together, is it going to be in a frame? Or is it going to be on the wall? Is it going to be freestanding? You know, you got to start somewhere. So you set that down, and let's say neither one of you know anything. You don't have to say anything, and you just start placing it in. It's like sand tray, you know, except it's going to be permanent eventually. So you start placing stuff and, well, she may not like it. She moves this and I add this. And after an hour or two, we got a beautiful piece sitting in front of us.
It's like a jigsaw puzzle, but you don't know what the picture is. And each of the shape of the puzzle, each puzzle piece is a unique shape. And yep. So you're putting together a new design.
Together.
And it's a mindless activity in that you're not thinking about other things. You're very present. And
it really inspires creativity and spontaneity and not being attached to what she's moving that I just put there. That's just equally as important.
And how you communicate.
Exactly.
I mean, sometimes people don't say a word and they have this whole idea, this whole story of what they're doing with their objects, and they don't share it with the other person until the other person asks. And then the other person can be joined in on the story or change it up a bit. You know, however you communicate, normally it will show up in the way you do art.
So eventually when you're both done, you'll know it. You look back and you're looking at this thing. It's magical. You take a picture of it. Very important. And then you take everything off and start gluing or screwing down what it is. Don't worry about attachment while in the creative process. Just don't even think about it. Because now you're going to start placing whatever's on the bottom. You start there first. And eventually the whole thing comes back and you're looking at the photo, until finally you're done with it.
Yeah. But you know, the photo, you know, also changes too. You Bingo. Don't have to do it the way the photo is.
I was going to say, you could probably change your mind.
And we do. We have the last one we did, we changed it several more times.
And actually, you know, he likes to do the photo, but most of the time I actually just take everything off and start gluing on the bottom. And I don't actually take a photo and changes.
Some of my pieces are really intricate.
And he has very complicated,
very complicated.
Complex pieces. So he does that.
But, yeah.
That's really fascinating. I think that's a really awesome activity for couples to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a couple of activities that we have couples do together to try to create together, but nothing that to that extent that you guys do. And I think I could see how, you know, when you create together and you don't place attachment,
that's it,
on what you're doing, it really strengthens that bond, you know, between the couple as they're creating together, right? Because now you don't have judgment about what your partner is doing. You're actually connecting and adding to it.
Right.
And you can have a conversation. We really support this. We thought about it. Is you talk up front, if you do have an attachment to that piece being there, what is your little phrase you're going to say? Well, I really like that there, instead of, you know, so it doesn't become an angst issue.
You have to figure that
out. Have a little conversation up front of how am I going to feel heard, and this is okay for me to be here, and you not feeling threatened that it's not going to be that way. So that level of depth and conversation can come up as well. And it's very enlightening to see what happens when couples want to create together.
You know, I was looking for research on this kind of doing this kind of activity together, and there's very little research on it. That love hormone oxytocin. They have done a little bit of research on couples. They had two sets of couples. One was playing a game together and the other was going to an art class together, and they tested the oxytocin levels before and after,
male and female.
Yeah. And they found that it increased more with the art activity. And they also found, surprisingly, that the male level of that hormone doubled, that they didn't expect that. And there really needs to be more research on this, because, you know, I know that you've said in your podcast, it's like, you know, getting married is easy. That's the easy part. It's like, you know, making a baby, but it's the years and years of work of maintaining a good marriage or being a good appropriate parent that is the work that nobody tells you about. And so this is one of the ways you can keep your marriage exciting. And it's like a date, you know, it's like going on a date, and so many couples don't even go on dates, but you could do this in your home and have a unique experience together that you don't have to go anywhere else and do.
And what it also does is supports the whole notion of recycling. Instead of throwing away some of the stuff that you know you don't want anymore, put it off in a box going, hey, well, we could do something with that art sometime. It's amazing what you would find once you dive into this thing, eventually your bar really, really lowers about what you're willing to keep. And it's not about hoarding. It's about seeing it from the artistic design point of where it was originally made and then thinking, wow, I could then do that with this.
Yeah, I mean, it goes along with decluttering.
Decluttering.
And as he said, you could actually put that stuff in a box and then decide, you know, another time that we're going to pull that box out and make an art piece out of it. Wow. And so that those objects never look the same again. Yeah.
Well, it definitely brings meaning, you know, to not only the objects you're putting together, but then also you're working together as partners.
Yes. And that is that's the most rewarding or wonderful thing about the art piece. Other people may not even like it, or they might. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
If the couple did it together, it represents joy. And
you said something earlier about how do you know when you're an artist? And it's like when you become a therapist, you go to school and someone tells you you're one, right. Even though the first time you sit across from someone, right. You don't know what you're doing, but you've got this title that you kind of grow into. Right. As opposed to an artist, you have this calling that you become that thing. And I think in our world, you know, we don't do so much of that. We do more of someone tell me what I am.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get trained in that. And that's instead of it being that inspirational kind of thing. And, you know, you just think about the way human beings have lived historically without all of our modern, you know, technology. You know, you used to sit on your porch and talk to your neighbors and, and you would have that natural bonding time that we just don't have anymore. Or you'd have to recover from a storm and you'd have to do some of this stuff. It's like you guys are creating something that brings that back to relationships and to the world that you don't really have to do it, but it's so good for us when we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way of saying it. Yeah.
Very much so. And when we share it with others through this assemblage camp paradigm, it's even more rewarding than we ever thought it would be.
Yeah. My favorite thing someone said recently was who would have ever thought that, what we're doing with the camp is that we rented some gallery space. So all the people who want to put their art in the gallery for 1 month
for
can do that for a show. We're calling it Casing the Joint. And so one person who's never done any art wrote me back and she said, I want to be in the show. And she said, who would have ever thought that, that being on my bucket list would be being in an art gallery. Who would ever thought that I'd be an artist in a gallery and that would be on my bucket list?
And she's in her 70s.
She was so far from her reality, and yet she got to widen her horizon there.
And her piece was complicated. Hers was hard.
Awesome. Which, by the way, Jean is an artist. She did this stained glass.
Oh, I've been looking at that and thinking, wow, that's some pretty cool art back there.
Nice. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
There was some detail going on there.
Yeah,
it's actually, I took a picture of the mountains that are that way that we're seeing out our window.
Yeah.
And then I blew it up and then I traced it. And so the purple up there, those are our mountains out there. And then we don't have a lake here, but I made a lake.
Oh, that's coming.
Some animals in it.
Yeah, that's
your future vision. The lake will be there.
And then it has lighting behind it. And when the lights are on, they're the LED lights that change colors, and it goes from like day to night.
Oh, that's very sweet. Very cool.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, but I've never done one for anyone else. I just do them for myself.
There you go.
Yeah, it was a stretch for me in particular to be in an art gallery for the first time, that other people come look at it and I put a price tag on it, and I'm getting more comfortable with it. And I have to say, compared to being in our house, having your art in a gallery with the perfect lighting and, you know, usually white background, it can really make it glow and be gorgeous more than it already is. I had no idea as an artist. I've been an observer of art in galleries, but I never had a piece in a gallery. So it's a whole different experience.
Yeah.
And I understand that we have a sample box coming our way.
You have, it was sent to you, and it's a book, and you have an assemblage kit, a starter kit. We call it out of the box assemblage starter kit.
So there'll be a bunch of items, and you can also collect items of your own. You don't have to use just those items. And you'll have a cigar box. Everything's recycled. Nothing is bought. And
other than the two glue bottles.
We did send you a couple little glue, tiny little glue bottles. And so go for it. If you wouldn't mind, you could send us a picture of it. We're putting it on our website of different people's art pieces.
And there's a brochure in it. It shows where you can go to our website. And it says out of the box, and you can watch the video of us doing one in fast motion to see how it's done.
It's kind of cool.
It's fun.
That's awesome. And what is the website for our viewers?
Which is Harmony, like Harmony. And then the second word is gates, like the gates of a horse. So G-A-I-T-S, harmonygates.com.
And that's where they can get a copy of your book and a copy of the kit.
Yes. Yeah, not the kit. We don't sell the kits.
We are not selling the kits yet.
Okay.
But by special request, we just like
to. You know that we have discovered that people keep telling us that this is an incredible idea.
Yeah.
And it could be a business. And we're not there right at the moment. We do have a lot of items we could make boxes, but it might be a next step for us. We're not sure.
We even came up with the idea 2 weeks ago of doing these boxes and have therapists use them in their therapy sessions.
What I was thinking.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And now she could market it, a smaller market, hopefully, that therapists now can use it within the paradigm instead of a sand tray where you're building the sand tray and then at the very end of it, you knock it down, you leave. This is you take it home and you can change it or you can concretize it and glue it all together. We had one friend do it and he came back and goes, it's your own personal Rorschach test. I said, guess it is.
I am thinking about, I've been trying to figure out for years, actually, how to bring the assemblage art into the therapy room. And once we made these boxes,
it makes sense.
It really made sense. And I just did it with one couple, and it was very telling and very, 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 just very therapeutic for them. So I'm going to start doing it with individuals and families and see where it takes me in terms of the therapy.
I had a thought that you could have. They could have pieces that represent trauma and then pieces that represent protection. Cool.
Yeah. That's so what I do that in the sand tray. They take a picture of the tray, but then they leave. But to have it with them, that's powerful.
She has a pretty huge, huge sand tray collection. So it's just three walls filled with stuff.
For your listeners, sand trays is a tray of sand. And a whole bunch of little miniature objects of all kinds of different things.
To represent stuff in your life.
And that people will put them in the sand tray and work with the therapist. So sometimes when we're looking for an object for our assemblage art, we actually go into my sand tray collection because it's fine. I have probably 2,000 items, figurines and stuff. So sometimes we actually rob from that.
Cool. So last question.
Real quick, just you asked for the website. If anybody's interested about the book and just the journey and the artist in there, that's lostandfound.art. Lostandfound.art.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Yeah. And we're going to put all these links in the show notes.
Okay. Sorry. You'd asked. I forgot about
that. That'd be perfect.
Yeah. Very cool. So last question, what is it that your partner does that you know they love you?
You want one answer?
Yeah, whatever.
Okay, whatever.
Go ahead.
Okay, I got two little things. Okay, he reads to me at night because it helps me fall asleep.
In bed,
and he makes dinner for me.
I like him making dinner for her. Mm-hmm. When she is walking through the room and she'll just touch me on my shoulder as she's walking by. It's as simple as that because she comes from a family that didn't do that much. And early in our relationship, it just never happened at all. So I know that she's thinking about me or caring about me at that point. And the other one is she loves to bake. And so when she makes something and she thinks it's not good, and I start eating it, and she really, 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 I know that she's, you know, there's an appreciation thing going on there.
I try to make the things you like.
I know, but you know, you're making for yourself too. Yeah. We like to cook for each other. Beck, she told me when the first 6 months together, I asked her, how do you know that I love you or care for you? She goes, you make food for me. And I got it. That's it. So I do.
Well, you know, people have been sharing stories since the beginning of time to bond and heal and grow. And we hope that by you guys sharing your story, it's enriched your lives and the lives of our listeners.
Yep. You guys are very pleasant. Couple do what you do. And it's just wonderful that you're putting all this on the line and sharing it with folks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Esther and Spencer. Okay. And hang out for a second here.
Yeah.
Once we end recording, we want to thank all of you for joining us on Couple Synergy today. Our passion is in helping couples and people have happy and healthy relationships. And this podcast gives us a fun way of bringing our knowledge and expertise to you, our listeners. For all of you listening, please let us know how you enjoyed the show. If you have any questions, comments, or topic suggestions, please email us at contact@couplesynergy.com. For more information about Couple Synergy and our programs such as Relationship 101, the home study course, the next Couples Relationship Enhancement Weekend, and our premier couples coaching program called Couple to Couple, look us up online at couplesynergy.com.
And if you know someone who could benefit from this episode, please download it and share it. And thank you for listening.
Until next time, synergize your life and synergize your love.
You have been listening to Couple Synergy with Dr. Ray and Jean Kedkodian. Couple Synergy was recorded, edited, and produced by Dr. Ray and Jean Kedkodian. Voiceover and music entitled Breathe and Let Go was recorded and composed by Gina Gonzalez.